Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, we're going back. We're going back for the third time in this year to the city of brotherly love, the city that I love, Philadelphia. Why do I love Philadelphia? Well, there are lots of reasons. I love it for the same reasons that most Americans do. It's the cradle of our democracy, and it's where the Constitution was written, all those reasons. But I have to also confess, I've got some other personal reasons. As many of you know, I went to law school at the University of Pennsylvania. I have fond memories of the people there. A shout out to Gary Clinton, my favorite administrator there. I also met my bride there. And indeed, at the risk of embarrassing her, I will tell you something. I proposed to her in a horse-drawn carriage circling Independence Hall. And she only made me wait 2 weeks before giving me her answer. Fortunately, it was affirmative. For all of those reasons, I love going back to Philadelphia. And this is the third installment of what I'm calling Philadelphia Stories. And in this installment, I'm going to visit the National Constitution Center, something that wasn't there when I graduated from law school in 1986. It was actually built in the aftermath of the bicentennial of the Constitution, which of course took place in 1987, a year after I left the city. And it's just a marvelous place, just a marvelous place. It had been years since I'd been back. It had been I'd never visited the National Constitution Center, but I had a great visit there. And in just a minute, I'll share some of that with you. But after I finished at the National Constitution Center, I also took a tour, a walking tour of Philadelphia, a constitutional walking tour, something else that I don't think existed when I was back there. And I'm going to share with you some excerpts from that wonderful experience as well. First, the National Constitution Center, and first, a discussion I had with a wonderful fellow by the name of Steve Frank. All right, I'm here with Steve Frank from the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. We're very grateful for the help we've received from the National Constitution Center. And Steve, will you tell us what your job is here, and we'll talk a little bit about the Constitution.
Sure, Stuart. Thank you very much for visiting. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you. I'm the Chief Interpretive Officer at the National Constitution Center, which is the equivalent of the staff historian.
Oh, wow.
I helped create the permanent exhibit and worked for the center before it opened in 2003, and have helped to create the programs that we do here.
Could you tell me a little bit about your own background? How did you get involved in constitutional law?
I'm a museum person,
right.
and museum people tend to have long, strange journeys towards their careers. So I started off as a journalist. At a certain point, mid-career as a journalist, I got a fellowship to spend some time at the University of Michigan for a year.
Right.
And there I got bitten by the history bug.
Right.
So I ended up changing careers and went to graduate school, became a PhD in American history, thinking that I would have an academic career, but instead ended up in museums and haven't looked back. I've enjoyed it. I've been doing this work now for about 15 years.
Wow.
And have been with the Constitution Center since 2001.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, why don't we begin then, since you were here since the inception of the National Constitution Center, why don't you just tell us what it is, how it came about, and all the rest of it?
Well, it's one of the nation's great museums, and it's a really tremendous way to learn about the Constitution and to learn American history. It's a highly interactive museum. We try to make learning fun. We try to make it inspiring. And we try to teach people about the importance of the Constitution. You mentioned when you walked into the building what a beautiful place this is.
It is beautiful.
And we think that, part of the impact of visiting the Constitution Center is simply seeing the magnificent structure that we built. And we feel that people will understand that the Constitution may be even more important than they thought it was when they walked in just by looking around, because it is an inspiring place.
I think that's really true, and it's kind of funny. I spent yesterday over at Independence Hall. Marvelous place, lots of history happened there. But I was struck by the fact that most people who visit it think only of the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, I don't think, even realize that the Constitution was drafted in the very same room as the Declaration 11 years later. And then they kind of skim over entirely where the Supreme Court met next door, or Congress Hall, where mm-hmm. Congress met for the next 10 or 15 years. And the Constitution just kind of tends to get lost in the shuffle, or at least it did before you opened this place.
I think that's true, and we'd love it if visitors to Independence Mall started their visit here, because it really explains the importance of Philadelphia and what happened in Independence Hall in a way that that you don't appreciate unless you do visit the National Constitution Center. It's interesting. I was here, as I said, you know, even before ground was broken on the.
Let's talk about that. Who came up with this idea? How did this come about?
It was an idea that had been actually kicking around since the bicentennial of the Constitution in
1987.
A group of civic-minded Philadelphians felt that there should be some commemoration of the Constitution here in Philadelphia, you know, where it was written, associated with the bicentennial. But it took a little while to figure out what exactly they wanted to do and to build up a head of steam and the political will to get something this amazing accomplished.
And so, to raise all the money necessary. I'm sure it cost a pretty penny.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But at some point in the early 1990s, when Ed Rendell was the mayor of Philadelphia, the project captured his imagination. And with that political will, it started picking up a head of steam. And we broke ground in 2000 and opened the building in 2003. It's really a testament both to Ed Rendell's political will, his vision, and also the vision of our founding president and CEO, a guy named Joe Torsella, who is now an ambassador to the United Nations. So it really took a lot of work and the creative energies of a lot of different people, the generosity of a lot of funders to create the place. But
I was noticing all the major corporations and the major organizations and individuals who are on your founder's wall out there in the front. Quite mm-hmm. an impressive array of people.
Well, this was an interesting private-public partnership.
There was both federal, regional, and
city and state money that went into the building of the place, as well as private fundraising. And now that we're open, it's entirely private fundraising. There's no longer any governmental support, which is one reason that we charge admission.
It's well worth it. Now, you mentioned a moment ago that you designed the permanent collection here, right?
The permanent exhibition, yeah.
Well, tell us what's in that for those who are thinking of coming here. Give them an idea of what they will see, no matter when they come. What's in the permanent exhibit?
It's a comprehensive view of American history, and it starts with an extremely inspiring theatrical multimedia production, really something that you can't see anywhere else in the world. And Sandra Day O'Connor, who happens to be on our board of trustees, once called it the best 17-minute civics lesson in America.
Oh, really? That's quite an endorsement, because, of course, that's one of her big causes, you know, in retirement. She has what's her website? Is it like iCivics.org?
Yes.
And a very impressive interactive website. Now, is that in conjunction with this, or is there any relationship between the two, or is that entirely separate?
You know, we've just started to think about programming relationships that we can do with iCivics, and we're working on that through Justice O'Connor.
Okay, but I digress. So we start with our 17-minute multimedia presentation.
It's called Freedom Rising. There's a live actor. There's a 360-degree screen.
Wow.
And there are other visual multimedia effects. And it's a history of the United States from the time of the founding right up to the present day. And that's in a big circular theater. As you exit that theater, you enter the main exhibit gallery, which is also a big circular gallery. And there, too, you get a comprehensive overview of American history from the perspective of the Constitution. You come to understand how the Constitution has affected American history. And we like to say that we tell the story of we the people. And we tell that story in two senses of that phrase, the great first three words of the preamble. In the sense that that the idea of popular sovereignty, government by we the people, is the fundamental idea of the Constitution, that it was a revolutionary idea in 1787, a world ruled by kings and czars and emperors, where this revolutionary idea that the people could govern themselves was set forth here in
Philadelphia.
Right,
this is the first time in all of human history, correct me if I'm wrong, that a group of people simply sat down and said, how shall we design a government? And let's do it from scratch. Let's do it as close to scratch as one can get, given the history of the times. Mm-hmm. But that's really the first time it ever happened, and that's what we call the American experiment, isn't it?
It is, and that's the story that we tell, starting with that, and how that experiment has unfolded over the generations, and how millions of people have contributed to that story, so that the other sense in which we tell the story of we the people is how that phrase, that circle of citizenship, the American polity, has become more inclusive over the years to include people and groups who were left out in the beginning, women, people of color, Native Americans.
So you don't just talk about 1787 or 1791, you talk about the full range of the history of the Constitution.
We like to say that we don't focus on one founding moment, although we celebrate that founding moment, because there have been many founding moments throughout American history, and we try to point them all out.
Oh, that's so good. In fact, I'm very glad you mentioned that, because here in Philadelphia, of course, it's easy to get overwhelmed by history. As I mentioned, I was over at Independence Hall yesterday. Marvelous place, wonderful stuff. But you can leave Philadelphia, if you're not careful, with the impression that the Constitution all kind of finished up by about 1800, and that was it. Well, no, it's very much an ongoing story, and I'm really looking forward to seeing all these other exhibits. Tell us what else you'll see after this multimedia presentation, then.
Well, just to pick up on that idea that it is an unfolding story, in the exhibit gallery there, the Constitution itself is etched in glass around the entire gallery, a 400-foot-long
Constitution. That is so cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
And we left some panes of glass empty at the end, in case the Constitution is amended in the future, as it surely will be.
What a great idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was your idea.
It wasn't my idea.
That was your exhibit, though. That's great.
That was the exhibit designer's idea. One of the terrific things about working at a museum is how many creative people bring their talents to bear to create a place like this and an exhibition like the one you're about to see.
Great. And then what else are you going to see after you see the big etched Constitution?
Well, there's a chronology wall, a timeline that's highly interactive, and the designer's idea there was that all of these events have kind of flowed up into that Constitution to make it the Constitution that we live under today. And there's a central pathway through the exhibit called the Preamble Path, which is much more about how the government works today, the framework established by the government. And there you get to participate in some of the great rights of citizenship. You can take the oath of office as president. You can sit at a replica of the Supreme Court bench and decide a number of landmark cases before you find out how the justices themselves decided them. You can vote for your favorite president. You can sit in a jury box and hear the bailiff tell you the importance of jury service to the American system of justice. So there are lots of things to do and lots of immersive experiences to have when you visit the Constitution Center.
That is great, and I imagine that appeals to all ages, but listeners can't help but hear in the background here that we've got a lot of people coming through here. And when I walked in this morning, I was almost bowled over by dozens, perhaps hundreds, it seemed like thousands of children coming in here. And that's very inspiring. It's very inspiring to see young people who may not even know what the Constitution is coming here. And then I imagine they like doing things like taking the oath of office or sitting up on a bench.
I think they do, and we like to think that, if they enjoy it, they'll come back with their parents, and their parents will enjoy it too. We felt that by designing the center to be appealing to young people, we would make it appealing to everybody, and we consciously tried to do that.
It's kind of a cool idea to think that there might be some little boy or girl taking that oath of office today who might do it for real 30 or 40 years from now.
That was exactly the idea.
Really?
The idea to inspire that kind of interest. So so we certainly hope that will happen. That was our intent.
That's great. Okay, what else then? Is that pretty much the whole permanent exhibit?
That's the permanent exhibit, but we're about much more than just the permanent exhibit. We have educational programs that that go out into classrooms. We have lecture series that happen here in the evening. We have a website, constitutioncenter.org. We have a blog.
Constitutioncenter.org. That's one word, constitutioncenter?
Yes.
.org. Okay, so listeners can go to that. Is that also fairly interactive, that website?
It is.
Okay.
And we have a blog called Constitution Daily, which we encourage people to read.
Okay, very interesting. Now, the permanent exhibit is what people will see no matter when they come.
Mm-hmm.
But I also notice that you have what looks like a very interesting exhibit out there at the moment, and I think maybe a lot of those kids are really looking forward to it. Could you describe that?
We do. We have a regular program of feature exhibitions, and the current feature exhibition, which will be here through almost till the end of August, is Spies, Traitors, and Saboteurs.
Spies, Traitors, and Saboteurs. And as I was waiting for you all this morning, I noticed in the gift shop that you have all sorts of spy paraphernalia and books, including even some small child-sized black fedoras that they can pull over their eyes and look mysterious in. And that's another great idea, to bring people in who might not otherwise say they want to learn about the Constitution, but then realize that Constitution has a lot to say about those issues, about what is, in fact, treason is specifically defined in Article 3, and that's a big issue. Because it has to do with free speech and all of that. Could you tell us a little bit about that exhibit?
Well, that exhibit was developed by the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C.
Another cool place that I have not been to yet. My whole family's been there, and I'm going to go. But go on, please.
Another place to visit.
I will go.
They're known for creating very highly interactive, engaging exhibits, and this one is exactly that. And it raises some interesting constitutional questions about how you balance national security with civil liberties. So that's the reason that we took it.
Rather a big issue these days, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. This summer, we're going to have another feature exhibition, The Real George Washington from Mount Vernon.
Discovery. Oh, you're killing me. When is that going to happen?
That opens in July 1.
July of this year?
Yes.
We devoted an entire episode to George Washington and his importance to the Constitution, because everybody thinks of George Washington as a general, as a president, maybe even as a land surveyor. Nobody thinks of him and how important he was to the adoption and the implementation of the Constitution.
Absolutely. It wouldn't have happened without him. He presided over the Constitutional Convention,
right,
as you well know.
Right.
Didn't have much to say until the very end, but his presence was enormously important. It wouldn't have been accepted by the American people without him.
Right. Well, Steve, you and I are obviously on the same page here. But let's go back to the spy exhibit. What kind of cool stuff is in there that people will see if they come?
One of the interesting things in that exhibit, and there are lots of very immersive kinds of environments, are polling stations throughout the exhibit, so that you get to let us know how you feel about some of these issues, about balancing civil liberties and national security. There are a number of really interesting episodes from America's past, some troubling ones, including Japanese internment during World War II, that are explored in the exhibition.
Okay. Well, anything else about the National Constitution Center itself that you want to share with us?
Only that it really is a must-see destination in Philadelphia. Anyone coming to Philadelphia for an American history experience really owes it to themselves to make some time to visit the National Constitution Center.
And where are you located?
We're right on Independence Mall, just two blocks from Independence Hall,
right,
where both the Declaration and the Constitution were adopted.
Right.
In fact,
when you step out the front door, you're looking right across the mall at Independence Hall, aren't you?
There's an even better view from the second floor of the Constitution Center. The best view of Independence Hall in Philadelphia is from this enormous glass window on the second floor of the Constitution Center. It frames it. And when we were building the place, and you noticed that the Constitution Center is a very modern white limestone building, not the colonial red brick building that you necessarily associate with Philadelphia and Independence Hall, the architect told us that this building and Independence Hall were talking to one another, that they were in conversation, and that the conversation they were having was about where America has come over the course of more than 200 years.
And if people come here, they can eavesdrop on that conversation. conversation, can't they?
Absolutely.
Tremendous. Well, Steve Frank, thank you so much for telling us all about the National Constitution Center. It is a great place to go and a great place to start any tour of Philadelphia. So that's marvelous. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're going back to Philadelphia, and we're right in the middle of a visit to the National Constitution Center. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our tour. Stay tuned.
The Preamble to the Constitution.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
It's time for the Constitutional Quiz, and with us, as always, is Kelly Carmichael from the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Well, hello, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing very well today, and I have a smiling, excited, eager contestant who I will ask to introduce herself and tell us where she's from.
I'm Isabella Valcarcel, and I'm from Arequipa, Peru.
Arequipa, Peru?
Peru.
That is extraordinary. And your first name is Isabella?
Isabella.
That's just lovely. Well, thank you so very much for being
Isabella,
here.
Isabella from Peru, and we're asking her a question about our U.S. Constitution. I love it.
Tremendous.
Well, I'll play the foreign card, the foreigner card.
The foreigner card. Okay, good. Well, what do you got for her, Kelly?
Excellent. All right, Isabella. I'm happy you're smiling, and hopefully at the very end you will be smiling with your very own Your Weekly Constitutional T-shirt. Woo-hoo. All right, here's a question. Separation of powers, the idea of separation of powers, refers to the division of authority between, is it A, national, state, and local governments, B, legislative, executive, and judicial branches, C, state, county, and municipal government, or D, married couples?
There's a distinct division of authority between the married couple I'm most familiar with. My wife has all the authority. Okay.
Yeah, perhaps there's more than one correct answer in this one.
I see. It very well could be. All right. Isabella, why don't we go through those together, shall we?
Sure.
Well, Kelly, could you go through them one by one, please?
Sure. Separation of powers refers to the division of authority between A, national, state, and local governments.
Is that the correct answer?
No, that is not the correct answer.
She seems quite certain that that's not the correct answer. All right, what's B then?
Is she still smiling?
She's smiling. In fact, she looks positively predatory. I think she thinks she knows the answer.
All right. Is it B, legislative, executive, and judicial branches?
That's the correct answer.
There is an aura of certainty emanating from Isabella. She's just sure that it's B. Okay.
We have some confidence here. I like it.
I like it too. But what about C? What was C?
State, county, and municipal government.
That is not correct.
Well, then finally D?
Well, that's
D.
Always correct.
Married couples. Okay.
Married couples.
All right, we'll strike that one off simply because it's always correct in some sense. And you're absolutely sure. Explain to me your rationale. Why do you think that it is B, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches?
It was a question on the becoming a citizen test that I got right.
This is so cool, Kelly.
Oh, this is great.
So
this
citizenship test. And she had to know about the separation of powers, and so she simply remembers her correct answer.
You know, there's lots of debate out there that, you know, folks who are citizens and born in America should be taking the citizenship test, that we all not even those who are becoming citizen, that we all should take that test. And there's lots of debate around that question.
You know, I've always felt that as a policy matter, that was a very good idea because it's, you know, the rest of us who are native born take it as our birthright, which, in, you know, in a sense it is. But that doesn't mean that we have no responsibility to learn. I don't know, it's not a bad idea. Maybe everybody should take that test. Did that help Isabella? Did she actually get the answer correct?
Isabella, congratulations. You are a proud owner of your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
All my dreams.
All your dreams. Well, congratulations, Isabel. I have to ask, are you a citizen now? Did it actually go through and all that?
Oh, yeah.
Tremendous.
It worked out. That and my T-shirt, I'm golden.
But which excites you more, being a citizen or the T-shirt?
The T-shirt I can use every day.
You're a citizen every day, though, too.
they're of equal importance, no doubt. All right, thank you very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're going back to Philadelphia, and right now we're visiting the National Constitution Center. Now, we've just finished our discussion with Steve Frank, who actually designed many of the exhibits at the National Constitution Center. But as he said, the very first thing that most visitors will see is a presentation, a multimedia presentation called Freedom Rising. And in just a moment, we'll go and we'll listen to some excerpts from that. But just let me explain that after you've bought your ticket, and after you stood in line for a few minutes, you walk into this remarkable circular stadium-like auditorium. It's surrounded by large screens, again, in a circle. And at the bottom of the stadium is a circular stage. And onto that stage strides an actor in period costume. And he will narrate parts of it. And then the screens will take over. And then he'll narrate it. So it's partly a live show, partly a recorded show, but well worth your time. So let's listen in.
The nation has its own role, but none has total control. This is what no country had ever done, to control power by dividing it, putting it under the limits of a constitution, and then placing the final authority with you. And you, and you and me, and you. The power and the responsibility for freedom belong to us. We, the people. Vermont's Benjamin Franklin looked at the symbol of the sun carved on the back of George Washington's chair. He wondered, is it rising or is it setting on our young nation? Now I have the happiness to know, said, it is a rising sun. The founders created a constitution that would be open to the future by making it possible for us to amend. The first 10 amendments, called the Bill of Rights, are sonata, protecting our freedom of religion, freedom of speech, right to a fair trial, and other essential liberties. The future of America is set in motion by this Constitution, but is made real through the voices and day-to-day actions of we, the people.
For us, the living, to be dedicated to the unfinished work, the great task, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
It would take 75 years of the Civil War to abolish slavery, and another century to overcome the legalized racial segregation which followed.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live up.
Through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in the need of people.
This is the path of freedom being figured out, and millions are drawn to these shores.
As New York slowly emerged, everybody was cheering. America!
All the while, our definition of being the people grows broader and stronger.
It is the duty of the women of this country to secure their sacred right to the elective franchise.
Within this expanse of freedom, we create families and communities.
This great nation will endure as it has endured.
Wow, wasn't that remarkable? That was part of the remarkable presentation, Freedom Rising, at the National Constitution Center. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to simply let you follow me as I walk out of the Freedom Rising presentation and start into the permanent exhibit at the National Constitution Center. So the first thing you're going to hear is the tour guide, who is standing right outside the door and who points you in the right direction.
That's where you'll see the exhibits. They're in chronological order, starting with the original printing of the Declaration of Independence, and then going on through to the today's society. Make sure you stop and look at the people on the national tree. You also see at the top is the Constitution itself. And that's printed on the top of the outside of the wall, and it goes through the entire Constitution, and then, of course, all 27 amendments.
To really understand the Supreme Court, you must see it in action. Select one of the following actual cases and see how the justices handled it.
Is often called upon to judge very controversial cases, ones charged with high emotion. This is one of them. It is the summer of 1984, the Republican National Convention in Dallas. Demonstrators also came to Dallas to protest the Reagan administration's policies. At the end of one demonstration, a radical protester, Gregory Lee Johnson, held up an American flag, soaked it with lighter fluid, and set it on fire. While the flag burned, the protesters chanted, "Red, white, and blue, we spit on you." Johnson was arrested under a Texas state law outlawing the desecration of the flag. He was fined and sentenced to 1 year in prison. The conviction was appealed to higher courts by lawyers saying that the Texas law went against the First Amendment's provision of free speech. On March 21, 1989, the case was argued before the Supreme Court. Listen now to the actual sound recordings of the arguments. First, you will hear Kathy True, who is defending the Texas law.
We believe that the preservation of flag as a symbol of nationhood and national unity is a compelling and valid state interest. We feel very certain that Congress has the power to both adopt a national symbol and to take steps to prevent the destruction of that symbol, to protect the symbol.
As often happens in these arguments before the Supreme Court, justices will interrupt to ask questions. This is Justice Antonin Scalia.
Why did the defendant's actions here destroy the symbol? His action does not make it any less a symbol.
Your Honor, we believe that if a symbol, over a period of time, is ignored or abused, that it can, in fact, lose its symbolic effect. Texas is not suggesting that we can insist on respect. We are suggesting that we have the right to preserve the physical integrity of the flag. I think the flag is this nation's cherished property. The government may protect the flag because it is such an important symbol of national unity.
This is Stuart Harris, and I'm walking through the permanent exhibit at the National Constitution Center. Listen in.
I understand that this flag has serious important meanings, that it's not just pieces of material, blue and white and red, but it may have different meanings to other people out there. I think it's the most important case. I sense that it goes to the heart of the first person, to hear things or to see things that we hate. Test the First Amendment more than seeing or hearing things that we like. It wasn't designed for things we like. They never needed a First Amendment. This amendment was designed so that the things we hate can have a place in the marketplace of ideas and can have an area where protest can find itself.
Now I'm being asked, how would you have decided this case? Touch one of the icons and see if your opinion corresponds to what was actually decided in the case. I'm going to pick no. I'm going to say that the law should be declared unconstitutional.
Versus Johnson. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Gregory Lee Johnson.
Many cases that come before the Supreme Court are not cut and dried, and frequently the justices disagree among themselves. When this happens, the majority writes an opinion, but the minority also gets to write a dissenting opinion, which can be very important in future decisions. In this case, the majority of the court did agree with you, but the result could not have been closer. 5 justices voted to strike down the Texas law, but 4 justices voted to uphold it.
Justice William Brennan wrote for the majority.
If there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea because society finds the idea offensive. We have not recognized an exception to this principle, even where our flag has been involved. We are tempted to say that the flag's deservedly cherished place in our community will be strengthened, not weakened, by our holding today. Our decision is a reaffirmation of the principles of freedom and inclusiveness that the flag best reflects, and of the conviction that our toleration of criticism, such as Johnson's, is a sign and source of our strength. It is the nation's resilience, not its rigidity, that Texas sees reflected in the flag, and it is that resilience that we reassert today.
Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote a dissenting opinion.
The right of free speech is not absolute at all times and under all circumstances. The result of the Texas statute is obviously to deny someone in Johnson's frame of mind one of many ways of symbolic speech, but left him with a full panoply of other symbols and every conceivable form of verbal expression to express his deep disapproval of national policy. Surely one of the high purposes of a democratic society is to legislate against conduct that is regarded as evil and profoundly offensive to the majority of people, whether it be murder, embezzlement, or flag burning. Throughout more than 200 years of our history, the American flag has come to be a visible symbol embodying our nation. It does not represent the views of any particular political party or political philosophy. The flag is not simply another idea or point of view competing for recognition in the marketplace of ideas.
This is your weekly Constitutional. For those of you just joining us, you're following me, Stuart Harris, as I walk through the permanent exhibit at the National Constitution Center. It's quite a place.
You might think that those nine justices have an easy life in that building of marble behind me. They have a good salary, a job for life, and all they must do is interpret the Constitution. Well, as we've seen in this case, sometimes this job can be extremely difficult. The justices often find themselves in the middle of politically explosive issues. They are men and women with strong opinions, and like the rest of us, they don't always agree. But they are aware that the decisions made in this building can profoundly alter the lives of every American. Knowing that fact can create tremendous anxiety, but in truth, the greatest pressure is that which the justices put on themselves in trying to reach a decision which conforms to the Constitution. Justice Anthony Kennedy voted to overturn the Texas law against flag burning, but also felt it necessary to tell the world how personally difficult that decision was to make. "The hard fact is," he wrote, "sometimes we must make decisions we do not like."
Here's a display with just a bunch of law books piled up in what look like helixes reaching toward the ceiling. Reminds me of my first year in law school. I better get out of here.
"A big old trial by jury. Most of them, anyway. Jefferson, he was in Paris when all the other guys were doing the heavy lifting on the Constitution. But when he became president, he called the American right to trial by jury one of the bright constellations in our principles of democracy. Nowadays, people kind of take it for granted. After all, they see all these people here, judges, bailiffs, court clerks, lawyers. Why not let them run the show? It's what they get paid for, right? So what's the big deal? I'll tell you what the big deal is. You heard of we the people and government by the people, right? Well, here it is. When you sit in that jury box, you're granted the power to decide who's guilty and who's innocent. And it doesn't matter who you are, who your father was, or who you know. That power is yours. Now, the power is based on the rule of law. But it's up to people like you and me to exercise that power. We the people."
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional from Philadelphia, the cradle of our Constitution. We are actually touring the National Constitution Center. After the break, we'll continue that tour.
Read, what does the Constitution do? Read, what does the Constitution say? Read, now listen up and I'll tell you. Read the people.
Article 2 sets forth the executive branch. You got president, vice president, and all that. The president.
president has got to be American born, 35 years of age or more. The rest of the article says what being president's about, his powers, his duties, and how we can kick him out. He's commander in chief of all the military, but let's get to Article 3.
It's your weekly constitutional, where we're touring the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
Now leaving the main exhibit, and I'm going into Signer's Hall, which is a hall of statuary. Before you get there, though, you see a display on the Constitution and the Civil War. At the moment, the Signer's Hall is filled with a bunch of teenagers who are posing for pictures with the various statues, and now there's one boy over there who's decided he's going to pretend to be slapping the faces of several signers. That's what teenage boys do, I suppose. Standing next to the statue of Benjamin Franklin, it's very lifelike. He's seated in a chair with his cane in his right hand and his left hand extended toward the front. There's also a large book at the front of the hall where you can sign a copy of the Constitution. I don't think it's necessary for ratification, but it's a nice idea. These are all life-size statues, and they give you a very good idea of what these fellows actually looked like. All right, well, I'm standing right next to the statue of James Madison, and so I'm very pleased to report that I now have it on very good authority that I am, in fact, taller than Madison was. But George Washington is rather imposing. And Alexander Hamilton is very good looking, but very arrogant. I slapped George Washington on the back. He didn't react. There's a copy of the Constitution as it was printed in the Pennsylvania Packet, a local newspaper, on Wednesday, September the 19th, 1787. Thank you, but I don't believe it's mine.
No, but I'm just giving it to you. I don't know who's here. Do you work here?
No, I don't. I guess middle-aged guys, halfway respectably dressed, get mistaken for employees on a regular basis. Well, it seems that Steve Frank was telling me the truth. I'm standing on the second floor of the National Constitution Center, and I'm looking out the big plate glass windows. And directly ahead of me is Independence Hall. Straight across, about a two-block Independence Mall. To the right of me is the Liberty Bell Pavilion. Lots of greenery. There are lots of trees, and of course the buildings of Philadelphia, modern Philadelphia, surround us on all sides. It's a rainy day, but there are lots of people walking up and down the mall, coming into the Constitution Center. Very inspiring view. Well, this is nifty. As you walk along the second floor of the National Constitution Center and you are circling the main lobby, you pass by a series of plates in the floor which indicate each of the 50 states and the date that that state entered the Union. I'm passing by Illinois, which apparently entered the Union on December the 3rd, 1818. It's followed by Alabama, December the 14th, 1819. State of Maine on March 15th, 1820. Yeah. And I don't know what that was, but I guess someone's excited.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and you and I are taking a tour of the National Constitution Center.
All right, I am here at the entrance to the spy exhibit at the National Constitution Center with Art Silver,
yes,
who is going to talk to us a little bit about this exhibit and the values that it implicates.
The exhibit is a very good exhibit. It's very timely that it be here on the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
We've had so many visitors that we've extended the exhibit. It was supposed to close at the end of May, and it's going to run until August 27th.
Wow.
So that, in effect, validates the interest among the public in the exhibit. It's very, very authentic. There are marvelous artifacts in it, as you'll see. And what we do on the introduction to the exhibit is first we explain to people there have been no changes to the exhibit since the death of Osama bin Laden. It wasn't done by us, and we can't change it. It came from Washington. And then we ask people to consider as a values question, which I then explain has no wrong answers, but is nonetheless a very difficult question, where the balance is 10 years after 9/11 between preserving personal privacy rights. And I get kind of graphic. I talk about potentially cameras in dressing rooms and excessive type searches,
right,
taking off our shoes. We got an airplane, confiscating
scanners,
my wife's knitting needles once, so she lost part of a sweater,
right,
which she was not happy about, yada-da-da-da. But we also have to consider preserving national security.
So the balance between civil liberties and security.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So this is not merely an exhibit that is interesting from a spy perspective, though of course there's that.
Right.
But it's interesting because it implicates this extremely important constitutional question about privacy and our civil liberties,
which is really being challenged every day. And people are revising it. And I tell people to keep an open mind on it. And I again tell them that I'm not asking the question to embarrass them or to challenge them. There's no wrong answer. And then at the end of the exhibit, you'll see we have a board and some post-it notes available where we ask for your opinion. You know, are we achieving that balance all of the time, some of the time, and none of the time? And of course, the balance itself exists only in your own mind. So your concept of the balance and mine and this woman standing behind you and the gentleman sitting over here could be different.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nice meeting you.
You know, too bad Professor Beeman is here. You'd like him.
I've interviewed him. He was on my show 2 weeks ago.
So boy, is he smart.
He's a very bright fellow, but I'll tell you what, he's not very assuming at all. He's like you described Steve Frank. He's a very, very modest fellow.
Oh, my God, you wouldn't believe it. He's taught for 44 years. He must have started when he was about a year and a half.
I know. Yeah, he did. He looks good.
I can see his mother taking him to Penn to be a professor in her arms. I have his book, but you know what everybody calls him around here?
What do they call him?
Rick!
Yeah.
Nobody calls him Professor or Dr. Beeman or
right.
Professor. No, he's strictly Rick, and he loves this joint.
Yep, he's a nice guy. Nice, nice guy. And we talked all about his new book. Let me get out of your way here. Yeah.
Plain Honest Men?
Plain Honest Men. That was it.
I have it in my locker. I've read it, but I haven't had a chance to have him autograph.
The theme,
he said he'll autograph.
Oh, I'm sure he will. The theme of the show was who wrote the Constitution, and normally I'll have a couple of people on the show. The whole show was Rick Beeman. From the beginning to end, and it was fascinating from beginning
Stewart
to end.
A few weeks ago.
Yes, he was. As I say, if he's good enough for John Stewart, he's good enough for us.
Terrific.
Thanks a lot.
Have a nice day.
Thanks. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've been taking another trip to Philadelphia where we've looked at the National Constitution Center. But you know, I'm feeling a little claustrophobic. I think we need to get outside. In fact, this gives me an opportunity to share with you one other really great thing I did during my trip to Philadelphia. I went on something called the Constitutional
walking tour. It was run by a company. You can visit their website at www.theconstitutional.com. So theconstitutional.com. And if you go to that website, you'll see that this company operates a walking tour of the historic area in Philadelphia, taking you past many of the buildings that we've talked about some of them before in the show. But hey, look, it bears a little bit of repeating. We'll take some excerpts from that tour when I went there recently. It was a rainy day, and so it's a little bit harder to hear, but I think you'll really enjoy it. I think we'll start enjoying the tour when it went to the Declaration House, where Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence. And you'll be listening to Tommy the Tour Guide.
All right, here we have the Declaration House. This is where, in the hot summer of 1776, Thomas Jefferson wrote our Declaration of Independence. The house was originally owned by Jacob Graff, who was a merchant here in the city. And he rented two rooms at Jefferson upstairs, one to sleep in and the other one to work in. Now, Jefferson actually picked this house in particular because, believe it or not, it was actually on the outskirts of the city. It was very peaceful and quiet, which, unlike today, is not the case. Although he probably would have liked the Dunkin' Donuts across the street, though, right? He was an early riser. I'm going to put you to the brickwork here. This brickwork is called Colonial Brickwork, or Flemish Bond Brickwork. The red bricks are called the stretcher, and the black bricks are called the header. Now, these black bricks are actually overcooked bricks. They're burnt. The masons coated them with a special glaze after they are burnt, and what you can see is the checkerboard design in front of you. Now, this is a reconstruction of colonial brickwork. This is not original, but along the tour, I'll point out some original brickwork to you. Would you like to take a peek inside? Get out of the rain for a bit? All right, well, here we have, I think, the highlight of the tour and the highlight of Philadelphia, Independence Hall, the birthplace of America. This is where on July 4th, 1776, members of the Second Continental Congress gathered to debate, draft, and then sign our Declaration of Independence. Happened just down there in that lower room. Also in that same room on September 17th, 1787, members of the Constitutional Convention gathered to debate, draft, and then sign our U.S. Constitution. Now the gentleman behind me, George Washington, presided over the signing of our U.S. Constitution. Also in that same room was Benjamin Franklin. Now, Ben was in his early 80s. He was an extremely old man and had really seen the development and growth of America. And he noticed the chair that Washington was sitting on. It was a high-back chair with a picture of a half-sun. And, you know, Franklin, being very wise and very philosophical, wondered to himself whether that was a rising or a setting sun and how that reflected on America. So after we signed our Constitution, what do you think he came to? Was it rising or setting?
Rising.
Yeah, very good. It was rising. And he said, quote, "Now at length I have the happiness to know that it is indeed a rising sun and not a setting one." And actually, that chair is still in Independence Hall today. It's the only original piece of furniture left. Yeah. Oh, this is interesting. The film company originally wanted to shoot that scene. We're talking about the National Treasure. Nick Cage found Ben Franklin's bifocals. The film company originally wanted to shoot that scene inside the building, but, you know, Hollywood has a tendency to knock down, you know, walls and take out windows just to get that perfect shot that only lasts about 5 seconds in the movie. And National Park Services was like, no, you can't film inside. So they actually had to rewrite the scene with him running around on the roof. Yeah. Just behind me here is Old City Hall, and this served as the Supreme Court building when Philadelphia was the capital. Now, City Hall has moved now to the heart and center of Philadelphia, the intersections of Broad and Market Street, and it took 30 years to construct. And it was finished in 1901, and at the end of its completion, it was the largest occupied building in the world. And does anyone know who's on top of City Hall? Yeah, very good. William Penn sits on top of City Hall. Now, it was under a gentleman's agreement that no building would ever break the height barrier of William Penn's hat, just to pay tribute and honor to the man who founded Philadelphia. And that was true, and it lasted until 1987 when One Liberty Place was constructed, which surpassed the top of William Penn's hat. Now, this sent to effect the curse of William Penn, which many people believe took shape, and that no sports team would ever win a national title, which was true until 2008 when the Comcast Center was completed. And that's now currently the largest building in Philadelphia. And I'll point that out a little later on the tour. Now, construction workers on the Comcast Center were local Philadelphians, and they highly believed in this curse. So what they did was they took a small replica statue of William Penn and they welded it to the top of the Comcast Center, once again restoring him to the height of the city. And wouldn't you know, later that season, Philadelphia Phillies won the World Series, breaking the curse. So behind me is the Second Bank of the U.S. It was chartered in 1816. The building itself was completed in 1824. And then the 20-year charter it was on was vetoed by President Andrew Jackson in 1832, and the bank closed in 1836. It's modeled off a very famous building in Athens, Greece. Anyone know the building? Starts with a P. Parthenon. Yeah, the Parthenon. It was designed by William Strickland, who is known as the city architect here in Philadelphia. Now today, the Second Bank is a portrait gallery of famous colonialists from the late 1600s, early 1700s, including the gentleman right there behind you, Robert Morris. Now, Robert Morris was a financier of the bank and also of the Revolutionary War. He had loads and loads of money, but at the time of his death, he was penniless. He was broke, which was the case with a lot of men who had funded the Revolutionary War. But he was the signer of all three founding documents here in America. The Declaration of Independence, our U.S. Constitution, and can anyone name the third one for me?
Bill of Rights.
Good guess, but no. Articles of Confederation. I'll signer of all three. Also known as the first U.S. Constitution.
You know, I'm really sorry I couldn't share with you the entire constitutional walking tour. So we've had to take just this part and that part from it, but no tour of Philadelphia, certainly no tour of the historic district would be complete without Ben Franklin's house. Now, the sad thing is Ben Franklin's house no longer exists, but we know where it was, and that area has been preserved in an area called Franklin Court.
He was the Postmaster General here in Philadelphia. Well, I'll take you to know his post office in a bit.
Created library serial numbers that you find even now in libraries.
Uh-huh. Started our first public library in Philly.
He had the printing press. Bifocals.
He was an inventor. Did bifocals, the Franklin stove, swimming flippers, the glass harmonica, which Mozart himself composed a piece for. He's also an ambassador. A diplomat, a statesman, politician. He was he was an author. He wrote Poor Richard's Almanac. He started the very first volunteer firefighting company in Philadelphia. The first University of Pennsylvania, the first hospital, Pennsylvania Hospital. He was a busy guy, right? Really a Renaissance man.
And he was a beer drinker.
And he was, yeah.
And he said that beer is proof that God exists and that he wants us to be happy. Right.
Yeah. So I'll give you guys a couple moments to check out the alcoves here. And the one on the tree here is his privy pit. Anyone know what a privy pit is? Yes, it is his toilet.
So we get to look at Franklin's poop?
Okay. You see the hole.
I'm excited.
Franklin was the Postmaster General here in Philadelphia, and this was his post office, the beefy Franklin Post Office. It's the only post office in America that does not fly our nation's flag. And can anyone guess maybe as to why that is? I'll give you a hint. It's colonial themed.
So they didn't have the original, have today's flag back then.
We did not have our flag back then. And until what legendary character came around?
Betsy Ross.
Yeah, Betsy Ross. And we'll stop by her house a little later.
Just a second now. Is this an actual operating post office?
Yeah, it's a fully operational post office. And they still do hand stamps as well. You guys want to take a quick peek inside?
Sure. And Ben Franklin has the last word. This is the last part of my three-part series called Philadelphia Stories. And I'm very pleased to share them with you, and I want to thank Leslie Berry from the Constitutional Walking Tour for letting me record parts of the tour I went on. I want to thank Steve Frank at the National Constitution Center. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name's Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.